Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight where Senator Matthias Cormann makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. I think he said in the text today it's probably the third annual address to the Sydney Institute on budgetary matters, and it's great to have so senior a minister in the government back at the Institute after the election. So I'll introduce the minister briefly. He graduated in law, studied at the University of Notre Dame in Namur, at the Catholic University of Louvain and East Anglia University in Britain. He worked in business as general manager for HBF Health. He's worked as a political advisor to the Premier of Western Australia, Richard Corden, for Chris Ellison, a minister in the Howard government. But, of course, he's been a senator since 2007, held a number of senior positions in opposition and in government, and currently, of course, the Minister for Finance. And Matthias Cormann's going to talk to the Institute tonight on jobs growth and the importance of living within our means. Matthias Cormann, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Gerard, and it is good to be back at the Sydney Institute for the third annual address as the Finance Minister, talking about our plans for jobs and growth and living within our means. And it's great to be hosted here by Kingwood Mallison, and thank you so much to Gerard and to Anne Henderson, not only for inviting me again after the two last occasions, but for the contribution, the fine contribution you make to a policy debate and conversation across Australia on important topics. And it's also great to see familiar faces in the crowd. My valued friend and colleague, Barry O'Farrell, former Premier of New South Wales. This time round, instead of meeting before an election, we meet after an election. And the first thing I'd say, it's good to be back. And it's good to be back talking to you from the vantage point of government, rather than from the alternative, which is not as attractive. There have been countless conversations since the election about how close it was, and of course it was. The bottom line, though, is the coalition won and Labor lost. The reason Bill Shorten lost the election is because the Australian people ultimately decided that they could not trust him with their money. Having been a senior member of a Labor government which put Australia on an unaffordable and unsustainable government spending growth trajectory, he spent his first period as opposition leader undermining the government's budget repair efforts. While it may have been good politics for Bill Shorten along the way, at the conclusion of the last parliament, it got him into a real fiscal pickle. During the election campaign proper, the worst possible time. Ultimately, I would say it's arguable that cost him the votes he needed to win. Remember, in the middle of an election campaign, he had to walk away from long-standing spending promises, like his promises to restore the school kids' bonus, or his promise to reverse our reforms to pension asset test arrangements to make them more affordable and more sustainable. He had to finally admit, arguably at an inconvenient time for him, that those promises were unaffordable. Also in the middle of an election campaign, he was forced to change his mind and express support for billions of dollars in unlegislated spending reductions, which he had steadfastly opposed for years. Then there was Bill Shorten's spendometer, with one unfunded election spending promise after another. And he had already been forced to admit that if elected, compared to the coalition, he would increase the tax burden on our economy by more than $100 billion over the medium term. something that was demonstrably bad for our economy, in particular for investment and jobs. But to top it all off, after dropping long-standing but costly spending promises, being forced to back many of our savings he had previously opposed, promoting billions of dollars in higher taxes, in the most crucial phase of the election campaign, when he had to reveal the bottom line impact of all his adopted policy positions, Bill Shorten had to admit that Labour in government would deliver bigger deficits and higher debt than was reflected in the pre-election economic and fiscal outlook. Incredibly to many, he admitted to $16.5 billion worth of bigger deficits over the Ford estimates period, which respected economists said would put our AAA credit rating at risk. Bill Shorten went into the last election campaign unprepared for the important task of responsibly managing our economy and our public finances, and that is why he lost. He was not strong enough during his first term as opposition leader to back a genuine budget repair effort by staring down his high-spending Rudd-Gillard-era caucus colleagues. And out of a combination of political convenience and opportunism, he went for the lazy option of promoting tax hikes and more debt instead of doing the harder yards of presenting an alternative plan for genuine budget repair based on reductions in unsustainable spending growth. And to cover up that lack of preparation, during the election campaign period, he went for the big lie about a non-existent government plan to supposedly privatise Medicare. That worked for him then, to a point. Labour still recorded its second lowest ever primary vote in its history. And importantly, this sort of political operation, like the Mediscare, won't work for him next time when people can see that Medicare not only remains strong, but was manifestly not privatised under our government. Now, by now you'd be wondering, why does he tell us all that? Why does it matter? Why does he dwell on this with us here tonight when, yeah, we've won. So it is our job now to implement our plan for the economy and to continue with our efforts to repair the budget. The reason I dwell on this is because the Labour attitude to budget repair, to the proposition of living within our means in our political system, does matter. Because consistent with a long-established pattern in Australian politics, the government does not have the numbers to pass any legislation through the Senate in its own right. So Labour's attitude to budget repair will again matter in this parliament, and Bill Shorten remains as the leader of the Labour Party. And what I would put to you tonight is that for somebody who continues to aspire to be the next Australian Prime Minister, it is not good enough to try and keep hiding behind the Senate crossbench. As it wasn't good enough for Bill Shorten to eventually support savings during an election campaign when they could have long been legislated and put Australia on a stronger fiscal foundation much earlier, if only he had been able to make such a decision in a more timely fashion. And I'm not even talking about what appears to be potential backflips from the backflip. So when we go back to Parliament in a week's time, the question for Australia is whether Bill Shorten has learned the lessons of his past term of Parliament and how his failure to develop and embrace a credible fiscal strategy ultimately hurt him at the election. Will he be stronger in this term of Parliament than in the last? Will Bill Shorten step up to the plate on budget repair in this Parliament, or will he continue to be like a jelly on that plate? The wibble-wobble, wibble-wobble jelly on a plate, first opposing, then supporting, then not knowing what to do. He has said since the election that he would be constructive in this, the 45th Parliament. But will the Labour caucus let him? Will he be strong enough to force his shadow cabinet and his caucus to accept that budget repair and getting spending growth on a more affordable and sustainable trajectory is important for our economy and for every Australian? His reaction to the Prime Minister reminding him last week of the savings commitments he made during the election campaign, specifically his commitments to support some of our unlegislated savings measures, was sadly not very encouraging. We should not even have to have a conversation about those. we should be able to accept as read the bipartisan pre-election commitment to implement $6.5 billion worth of savings, which Labor endorsed during the last election campaign by enshrining them in their pre-election costings. In fact, that should only be the absolute minimum starting position. Labor is a mainstream political party which aspires to government. So our message to Labor is, live up to your best instincts and best traditions of national interest reform and work with us in this Parliament to restore the necessary fiscal foundations for stronger growth, higher living standards and stronger, sustainably funded public services into the future. The time for game playing is over. The election is behind us, but the budget challenge and the economic reform challenge is front and centre here and now. I have long maintained that the real hero of the Hawke-Keating years of government was the late Peter Walsh, fellow West Australian and the tough-minded wheat farmer who, as finance minister, drove his colleagues mad by opposing spending proposal after spending proposal that he saw as wasting taxpayers' money. What I would say to Labor is this. You can be the party of Peter Walsh or the party of the spendometer, leaving more and more debt to future generations. You cannot be both. The key purpose of any government is to ensure our economy can be as strong and as resilient as possible, to ensure families across Australia and our future generations have the best possible opportunity to be successful and get ahead. That is what we committed ourselves to as a government over the past 3 years, and this will be our unrelenting and persistent focus over this next term, building on the progress we have made in our first term by implementing our plan for the economy, our plan for jobs and growth. Despite additional global economic headwinds over the past 3 years, our economy today is stronger than it was 3 years ago. Employment growth today is stronger than it was 3 years ago. But there is so much more work to be done to ensure we are in the best possible position to deal with any future economic or financial shocks and in the best possible position to take advantage of economic opportunities, in particular in our region. While we are entering our 26th year of continuous economic expansion, we continue to face global economic headwinds. As a trading nation, we continue having to confront the implications for our economy of slower global economic growth and of lower global prices for our key commodity exports. We continue to be an economy in transition from record resource investment-driven growth to broader-based growth in a more diversified economy. But such a transition inevitably comes with challenges and at times difficult though necessary adjustments in individual sectors of the economy. Yet, achieving about 3.1% growth in real terms, our economy is comparatively strong by international standards. As I mentioned, employment growth is also stronger than 3 years ago, with the current unemployment rate of 5.7%, lower than previously anticipated and well below the OECD average. This doesn't happen by accident. There are structural features of our economic framework which are important facilitators of our transition. Our floating exchange rate, a significant economic reform of a previous Labor government. Historically low interest rates have helped our economic transition. But the government's economic reform agenda, focused on making our economy more internationally competitive, more productive and more innovative, have made and continue to make an important contribution to the success of our economic transition. A key attitudinal difference between us and our Labor competitors, as evidenced during the election campaign, is that the Liberal National Party coalition understands that for individual Australians to be the most successful they can be, the businesses that employ them need to be as successful as they can be. Our National Economic Plan recognises that by giving business the best possible opportunity to be successful, employ more Australians and pay them better wages. The government remains focused on making our tax system more growth-friendly. First, we abolish the carbon tax and the mining tax, followed by tax cuts, initially for small business. In this term, we will build on that by delivering lower taxes for hardworking families and by putting forward legislation to bring the corporate tax rate down to an internationally more competitive 25% for all Australian businesses, progressively over a 10-year period and starting with small and medium-sized businesses initially. As any credible economist will tell you, an internationally more competitive business tax rate will help boost investment, boost productivity, boost jobs growth, and over time, real wages. Personal income tax cuts, our 10-year enterprise tax plan, as well as our omnibus savings bill, will be among the first budget measures to be introduced into the 45th Parliament, alongside our bills to re-establish the Australian Building and Construction Commission, the Registered Organisations Bill, and our legislation to protect volunteer firefighters. Those tax cuts will help underpin stronger growth and more jobs in the years ahead, and alongside our innovation agenda, our defence industry plan, our export trade deals and our ambitious infrastructure investment programme will help us secure the successful transition of the Australian economy to broader drivers of growth in a more diversified economy. I've spoken before here at the Sydney Institute about the importance to our future prosperity and success as a nation of budget repair and getting back into a position where we can live within our means. Clearly that remains important. And I'll go through some of these reasons again. It remains important to ensure the important benefits and services provided by government remain affordable in our economy over the long term. Our social safety net, our world-class health and education system, our national security, all need a strong and sustainable fiscal foundation. This is particularly important given the structural challenges we are facing as a nation associated with the ageing of our population. An ageing population impacts significantly on a number of spending programs. Moreover, on current trends, an ageing population also means slower potential economic growth, which in turn has unfavourable implications for government revenue growth. Secondly, to reduce and over time eliminate the risks associated with increasing public debt. Rising indebtedness reduces the government's ability to ride out severe adverse shocks. It reduces the room we have to use fiscal policy to cushion those shocks while still keeping debt to prudent levels. And with our terms of trade here in Australia, more than twice as volatile as the average for developed economies, meaning we are more exposed to external shocks than other advanced economies, Australia needs a stronger balance sheet if we are to weather the inevitable future storms safely. Thirdly, because it is plain wrong to pay for our public consumption today with billions of dollars borrowed from our children and grandchildren every year. To keep doing this forces our children and grandchildren to pay higher taxes or accept deeper cuts in government expenditure down the track to pay back the debt accumulated on the back of deficit-funded recurrent expenditure today. This would lead to lower living standards for them than they could have otherwise expected, had they not have to pay for too large a chunk of ours. Today's debts are tomorrow's taxes. Restoring fiscal sustainability is every bit as important as ensuring we respect the environment future generations will inherit. Fourthly, to give ourselves a solid foundation from which to strengthen growth and create more opportunity for Australians to get ahead by helping us make our tax system more efficient and internationally more competitive. And just a fifth point. While Australia's government debt position still compares favourably with that of most other advanced economies, unless we continue to improve the spending and related debt growth trajectories left behind by Labor in 2030, Australia would be increasingly exposed to unacceptable risk. With the increase in government debt trajectory locked in by Labor during their period in government, the Commonwealth has gone from, and listen carefully to this, the Commonwealth has gone from receiving more than $1 billion in net interest payments in the last year of the Howard government to paying $12.6 billion this financial year, with interest payments expected to peak at $14.2 billion a year in 2018-19 before starting to decline as a share of GDP in 2019-20. That makes net interest payments one of the biggest areas of Commonwealth spending. So in 2007-8, the Commonwealth government collected more than $1 billion in net interest payments on the back of a positive net asset position. Now we're paying $12.6 billion on net interest payments, given the debt growth trajectory that we currently are dealing with. And that makes net interest payments one of the biggest areas of Commonwealth spending, as I've mentioned. For example, it is more than what we spend on pharmaceuticals or non-government schools or job seeker income support. This increase in government debt and interest payments has occurred in a global low interest rate environment. Interest rates will not always be at current record low levels. Even though the timing is uncertain, eventually they will return to more normal levels. If and when this occurs, if government debt levels were still at higher levels at that point, there would be a significant adverse impact on government payments and the budget balance. This is another important reason why budget repair cannot be delayed. There is much more work to be done on budget repair and getting back to a position where the Australian government genuinely lives within its means. However, we have made good progress. We're certainly in a stronger position than we would have been if we had not changed direction over the past 3 years by bringing our spending growth trajectory down. Given the size of the challenge we inherited in 2013, budget repair was always going to be a marathon and not a sprint, and we remain committed to the marathon. Our fiscal strategy is underpinned by our commitment to reduce government spending as a share of the economy over time in order to free up resources for private investment, with the payments to GDP ratio falling and stabilising before reducing net debt over time. A commitment to redirect government spending to quality investment to boost productivity and workforce participation, in particular investment in productivity enhancing infrastructure to drive stronger economic growth. A commitment to support revenue growth by supporting policies that drive earnings and economic growth. Our strategy sets out that new spending on higher priority policy pressures must be more than offset by spending reductions in other parts of the budget, and that any positive impact in revenue or spending as a result of changes in the economy are banked as improvements in the budget bottom line. That is a discipline, paying for any necessary expenditure on higher priority areas by genuine spending reductions in other parts of the budget. That is a discipline that we were able to comply with all the way through our first term. In fact, the net effect of spending-related decisions since we came into government in that first term of government was about a $10 billion improvement. When we came into government, we inherited $240 billion worth of accumulated deficits and a further $123 billion worth of projected deficits over the then 2013-14 Ford estimates period. Spending growth was running at 3.7% above inflation per annum over the medium term, with spending as a share of GDP expected to reach 26.5% by 2023-24, according to the National Commission of Audit, and expected to keep rising and rising, according to the most recent intergenerational report, well past 30% within a few decades. When you've got tax revenue as a share of GDP at about 22.4%, you can see why we're having a structural problem on the spending side of the budget. Long-term average in terms of taxes as a share of GDP at 23.9% still wouldn't be able to fund government spending going in excess of 30% and growing. We've been able to reduce the medium-term spending growth to 2.9% and stabilise spending as a share of GDP at 25.8% and are projected to bring it down to 25.2% over the current Ford estimates period. Importantly, many of our savings measures are structural savings, which improve our spending growth trajectory over time, starting low and slow in their impact and building over time. I'm pleased to report that the net effect of our more than 800 spending-related policy decisions, so 800 policy decisions on the spending side of the budget, which we have implemented since we came into government in September 2013, deliver a $221 billion net improvement over the medium term to 2026-27. So the net effect of more than 800 expenditure-related policy decisions since we came into government deliver a $221 billion net improvement over the medium term to 2026-27. $26 billion of that net saving falls into the period of the current forward estimates, building up to a further $195 billion in the period from 2021 to 2026-27. Savings measures are expected to build over time, with the value of projected gross savings growing from $30 billion in 2019-20 to around $50 billion in 2026-27. Put another way, if we had not made the decisions we have made over the past 3 years to reduce spending growth, our debt position would be increasing by about an additional $221 billion over the next decade, with the related additional public debt interest burden, which would come with that. This is an additional burden we are able to avoid based on the aggregate value of all the spending-related decisions made by our government since September 2013. We are now on a lower spending growth trajectory and a lower debt growth trajectory, and as such a lower public debt interest trajectory than we would have been if we had not changed Labour's past policy settings. Consequently, a return to surplus of around 0.2% as a share of GDP is projected for 2021, with the budget projected to remain in surplus over the medium term to 2026-27. The net impact of all unlegislated policy decisions of the government, as confirmed by the pre-election and economic and fiscal outlook, is about $18 billion in underlying cash terms over the current forward estimates. This includes about $15.8 billion worth of savings decisions made prior to the most recent budget and $2.2 billion worth of net improvements as a result of decisions announced in the 2016-17 budget. Our pre-election policy commitments delivered a further $1.1 billion net improvement to our budget bottom line. A substantial component of the 2016-17 and subsequent savings can be implemented either administratively or by passing the annual appropriation bills. $6.5 billion in savings will be the subject of our omnibus savings bill, for which we expect to receive bipartisan support. We will engage with Labour and all parties to achieve the successful passage of further budget improvements through the Senate. Ultimately, if we were unsuccessful in our efforts to bring the budget back into balance as soon as possible, it would mean higher debt levels than necessary, which ultimately means higher taxes or deeper spending cuts down the track. Labour's solution to their past decisions to permanently increase the level of Australian government spending and to put federal government expenditure on an ever-increasing trajectory as a share of GDP was to pursue significant increases in the overall tax burden in the economy. The truth is that increasing the tax burden in the economy, as Labour proposed during the campaign, would lead to less investment, less growth, and fewer jobs in our economy, which is manifestly not what Australia needs right now. Returning the budget to balance is an important part of our overall economic plan to deliver jobs and growth. This economic plan is what Australians voted for at the election. As I have already mentioned, our economic plan will make our tax system more growth-friendly. We will lower taxes for hard-working Australian families. This will reward families who choose to work more hours to get ahead. Our commitment to bring the corporate tax rate down to 25%, starting with small and medium-sized businesses, builds on the tax cuts we have already delivered and will drive investment, productivity, jobs, growth, and over time real wages. Despite slower global economic growth, our export trade deals will open up new business opportunities with China, Japan, Korea, Singapore, and the members of the Trans-Pacific Partnership. This will create jobs across Australia, in particular opening new growth opportunities for our highly successful service export industries and our agricultural sector. We are working to deliver additional free trade agreements with two of the other biggest economies in our region, India and in Indonesia. And indeed, we are exploring the opportunity for a free trade agreement with the European Union and are quite confident that we will be able to conclude a free trade agreement with the United Kingdom. Our ambitious infrastructure investment program will support our growing industries by better connecting them to international markets. This includes projects such as the Western Sydney Airport and Inland Rail. Our innovation agenda will drive growth in new industries and help current industries maintain their international competitiveness in this era of rapid technological change. This agenda includes ensuring our children are prepared for the jobs of the future by boosting participation in science, technology, engineering, and maths. Our defence industry plan will help build the technology and industry base that will help deliver a stronger economy, as well as boosting our military capability. Our microeconomic reform agenda will boost productivity growth. We are committed to restoring the rule of law to the construction industry by re-establishing the Australian Building and Construction Commission. We will ensure that unions and employer organisations have to comply with the same standards of governance and accountability as company directors. Our response to the Harper Review will increase competition across the economy, including strengthening the protection of small business from uncompetitive behaviour by big firms. This is the economic plan that Australia needs. This is the economic plan that Australians have just voted for. And this is the economic plan that the Coalition is working hard to deliver. And thank you so much for your attention.
Many thanks. And I should also say thanks to King & Wood Mellisons for the use of this fine facility. I think there are a few chairs around the back if anyone is standing wants to sit. There's a chair there, the chair's up here. So we come to questions and discussion, and we've got till no later than the top of the hour. You would be, I think, the first government that I can recall who's gone, in modern history, who's gone, in Australia, who's gone straight from a budget to an election. That's most unusual. Looking back now, since you didn't have the normal chance of revising the budget, is there anything there that you might revise now that you're back in normal political dealings? And do you think that'll have any impact on the opposition or the minor parties and the Greens and others, the fact that you actually are one of the few governments in Australian history who's actually had a budget endorsed by a subsequent election?
Well, thank you very much, Gerald, and you essentially answered the question with your final remarks. We took the budget to the Australian people, and the Australian people gave us that tick of approval, and we not only have a mandate, there's much talked about mandate to implement the plan that we took to the election. I mean, we consider that we've got a duty and a responsibility to implement the plan that we took to the last election. Now, as always with all things, a government consults about practical implementation issues, and there's always, I mean, this is not, nothing is ever completely in concrete, and things can be adjusted and improved, as in every budget and budget update, so there are further improvements. But I guess I would go back to one of the points that I made during my address, whether it is the discipline that we've imposed on ourselves in the past and the discipline that we will continue to impose on ourselves, is that if people come up with suggestions for improvements, which we then consider, which have a negative impact on the budget bottom line, then they will have to be paid for, and they will have to be paid for by measures that more than offset the cost of any such good idea to the budget. And that is the approach that Scott Morrison and I have been pursuing in this most recent budget successfully, and that is the approach that we will be pursuing in any future budget update and budget. That is what the Australian people expect us to do.
Senator, in just over a week's time, you'll be dealing with a new Senate, obviously. In your remarks, you talked about that this isn't all that different and that you'll have to negotiate things with a new Senate. And there are different views as to whether it'll be more complicated or less complicated than the last Senate. But can I just reference perhaps David Leonhelm, I think, in a week or so ago, gave a bit of a free character reference, that there seemed to be different approaches that the previous parliament or the previous government took to dealing with the crossbench. I think you were one of the successful counterparts in getting legislation through various measures. But is that a fair criticism? And do you think the Turnbull government can have a more sort of coherent, unified way of how they deal with the crossbench and try to get legislation through?
Very good question. The first point I would make is that in this Senate, for better or for worse, everybody who's represented on the crossbench in the Australian Senate today is there because a material number of Australians voted for them. In the last Senate, and it's not a reflection on them individually, they're good people, but like somebody like Ricky Muir was elected by lottery. He got into the Senate by lottery. It was a complicated system of group voting ticket arrangements where parties and party power brokers were able to negotiate preferences very efficiently with each other, and that you didn't need voters to determine where their preferences would go. I mean, essentially, once you put a one above the line in the Senate, which 97% of Australians do, your preferences would flow very efficiently and automatically without you doing anything else, to the point where a lot of minor parties were setting up other minor parties or micro parties where they were negotiating with each other and themselves on preference flows, and with some catchy party names like the No Carbon Tax Party and the No Taxes for Smokers Party or whatever, and every 500 votes that you get that way would be efficiently sent the way to the owning the majority shareholder party, for want of a better word, and it would be a lottery as to who would ultimately win. Now, in this Senate, that's quite different. But like the next point I would make is that in the last Senate, so we had the coalition had 33 senators, and we had three options to pass legislation. Either we had the Labour Party on side, and that was reasonably straightforward, or the Greens supported a particular proposal, that was reasonably straightforward. And then you had eight people on the crossbench, but who weren't one homogenous group. I mean, for us to be able to pass legislation with the crossbench, you needed to essentially convince six of them to support your legislation. And, once the Palmer United Party imploded, that was nigh impossible. I mean, we did a few, we did some good work, with David Lynham and Bob Dye, when Clive Palmer was able to deliver four crossbench senators to support a particular proposition in the national interest. But as soon as that party or that alliance split up, that was the end of that. And so with all of the goodwill in the world, we could negotiate for as long as we wanted with a David Lynham or Bob Dye. They couldn't deliver us the six votes we needed to pass legislation. And if we agreed with Bob Dye and David Lynham, chances were that meant that Jackie Lambie or Ricky Muir wouldn't agree. So in this next parliament, look, the future will show how it plays out. We've got, in this parliament, we will need nine people, either Labour, which is still the same, or the Greens, or nine of the 11 crossbenchers. And you've got four senators representing the One Nation Party. You've got three representing the Nick Xenophon team. And you've got still David Lynham and Bob Dyer. So that would potentially give you the nine. I might just make a final point related to this. Some people have suggested, you had eight crossbenchers in the last parliament. You've got 11 now. Isn't this doesn't this show that you shouldn't have gone to a double dissolution election? It's, the new set of voting arrangements and a double dissolution election has been a complete failure. I completely reject that proposition. It's, in fact, false, because if you look at previous Senate, the makeup of the previous Senate, it was in the 2013 election when the Liberal National Party had a very strong result. We won the election. We ended up with six new crossbenchers in a half-Senate election. Six new crossbenchers in a half-Senate election. If we had had another half-Senate election under the previous system of lottery and group voting ticket arrangements and backroom deals instead of empowering voters to determine who they vote for, I'm very confident that we would have ended up with a larger crossbench than the 11 that we've ended up with in this parliament. And the 11 that are here because a material number of Australians decided to support them with their vote or their preference. Yeah.
Senator, I'm interested to hear your views on the proposed change to West Australia's share of the GST, and interested to hear how that will help reduce the deficit.
Well, in relation to the last part of your question, it's got absolutely no impact on that whatsoever, one way or the other, because from the Commonwealth's point of view, because 100% of the GST goes to the states, it's a zero-sum game. So in terms of the federal deficit, it's got absolutely no impact whatsoever. Now, in terms of the question more broadly, when the GST was put in place as an important economic reform by the Howard government in 2000-2001, it was put forward as a reliable growth revenue for state and territory governments to help ensure that they had a sustainable revenue base for the services that they provide in health, schools, law and order, you name it. Western Australia today gets less in dollar terms than they got back in 2000-2001, while there have been significant increases elsewhere. Now, I've got to be careful. I'm a West Australian-based finance minister in the Australian government with obviously a responsibility to take a national perspective on these things. But I think it's fair to say that if state governments had known back in 99, whenever they signed the intergovernmental agreement, and they had known that there was a risk that any of them could fall to less than a third of their GST coming back, probably at that point in time, state and territory governments would have insisted on putting in a floor. Because, horizontal fiscal equalisation is very important. The principle of stronger states supporting states in need of support to ensure that we've got broadly similar standards of services across the nation is an important principle. The question is how far that can reasonably and fairly go, and, arguably, for a state like Western Australia to end up with 30% is perhaps a bit too low. Now, Western Australia, it is too low. Western Australia in the past has been a beneficiary, but no other jurisdiction has ever gone below 81 cents in the dollar. So, when this system has operated in the past, no state has, no other jurisdiction has ever gone below 81 cents in the dollar. So the reason why has this happened? The reason this has happened is because on the back of massive investment in our iron ore industry in particular, and the very high prices for iron ore and the royalty revenue that was able to be generated in Western Australia, most of that got distributed through the GST sharing arrangements around the country. And the scale was so significant that the numbers are there for all to see. The problem right now is that because the GST sharing arrangements are backward-looking, because the formula is backward-looking, the state of Western Australia gets 30% of their GST back still right now and last year and the year before, when the royalty revenue from iron ore has long collapsed. That's the challenge. Now, the Australian government for the last 2 years has been of the view that further drops in Western Australia's share of the GST were not appropriate. That's why we've made the decision to provide grants, direct unilateral Commonwealth grants to the WA government, about $499 million in 2015 and about $490 million in 2016 towards pre-existing WA infrastructure projects. But ultimately, over time, there ought to be a more sustainable, structural, long-term resolution to this. What the Prime Minister has said a few weeks ago in Western Australia is that as the WA share of the GST now is due to increase in the ordinary course of events operating under the current system, that this is the opportunity to consider whether as Western Australia exceeds a particular threshold to be determined, so passes it, whether this would be the appropriate time to put in a floor below their new share, because that means that prospectively no state and territory government would lose, but there would be some additional confidence in the integrity of the system in Western Australia, which quite frankly, in Western Australia right now, there isn't. So that's the context. But the specific question, how that impacts on the deficit, it doesn't impact at all.
Minister, living within our means, you've made comments about shortening Labour's irresponsibility, and few would question your own competence and contribution. But over the last 3 years, two Prime Ministers, two Treasurers, would you agree that the government has completely failed to communicate the importance and the overall importance of living within our means, in fairly simple language, to the whole of the Australian people?
Well, sir, that is, fair feedback from you. From my point of view, what I would say, and I know that all of my colleagues are in the same position, we get up every day and do the best we can to put Australia on the strongest possible economic and fiscal foundation for the future, to ensure that Australia is safe and secure. And ultimately, every 3 years, people get to pass judgment on know, their view on our performance and their view of our plans for the future and the alternative. And look, you know, the political history of Australia is there for all to see, and people will provide commentary in relation to these matters. My focus is every day, as well as the focus of my colleagues, to do the best we can to ensure we continue to make progress, to ensure we implement our policies to strengthen growth, to strengthen the opportunity for Australians to get ahead and to get our budget into a more sustainable position. Now, not meaning to argue, you know, our limitations, but, you know, spending cuts are not spontaneously popular. Sometimes you just got to keep at it and at it and at it, and you got to commit yourself to the marathon. And, you know, a lot of people think that, you know, one speech should fix, you know, the understanding across Australia of everything that we need to do in order to be in the best possible position for the future. And sadly, or not sadly, but the reality is, it's not as easy as that. We've just got to keep at it and at it and keep making the case, keep explaining what it is that we're trying to do and why it is important to the future of our nation, why it is important to the future of families across Australia, to the future of the next generation and the generation beyond that. And I'm confident that if we keep doing what we're doing, we will continue to make progress, heading in the right direction, and we will leave the country in a better place than we found it. But it's not a matter of just giving a brilliant speech and everything falls into place. It's really, it's a hard yards over an extended period.
A lot of mischief in the press.
There's nothing new there.
Say that the left is trying to undermine the right and the left quite the same. But what's the national attitude about China and all the stuff that we're reading in the press about their impact on Australia, buying the phone and selling us away from the rest of the world? That's popular attitude.
Okay.
Well, I mean, our attitude to China is very positive. I mean, obviously, we have an incredibly important trade relationship with China. Our business relationship, our investment relationship with China is obviously growing very significantly. Foreign investment for Australia generally is crucially important for our future economic success, for our economic development, as it has been. I mean, Australia, since its inception, since the inception of the initial colonies, I mean, we've been the beneficiaries of foreign capital and foreign labour. We've had, and we will need to continue to attract more foreign capital, and in the right circumstances, more migrants to Australia in order to be as successful as we possibly can be. Now, that doesn't mean that you don't put rules in place to ensure that foreign investment coming into Australia doesn't come here in circumstances which would be contrary to the national interest, of course. I mean, any sovereign nation ensures that it protects its national interest, makes sure that it does not make these sorts of decisions in a way that would be contrary to the national interest, and Australia is the same in relation to that, and that is what will continue to be the case in the future. But that is not a reflection on any individual country. That is a reflection on, obviously, the judgments that we have to make from time to time.
Question here.
My question has three parts. One, you need spending cuts, and I'm horrified to know that 50% of Australian households are receiving some form of welfare. What can we do about that? The second thing.
Well, hang on, I think we'll take one at a time.
All right.
Well, I think we'll take one. We'll come back to it. Okay. Response?
Well, I mean, the key when it comes to welfare, obviously, plays a very important role as part of our policy framework. I mean, I'm a passionate free marketeer. I'm in favour. I'm obviously very much in favour of the free market, but with an appropriate social safety net to ensure people who need support do receive that support appropriately from the government. Now, the key with welfare is to ensure that the welfare support goes to those in genuine need, and that it doesn't go to people who shouldn't be relying on welfare, and that any waste and inappropriate access to welfare payments is is eliminated. But I wouldn't make a blanket statement that to suggest that somehow there should be this massive cut to the level of welfare support. The most important thing that we can do, and this, our government is doing it, and we made some further announcements during the election campaign, is to make sure that there is proper integrity in the system, that the payments are appropriately targeted to those families and those Australians in most genuine need of support, and that it's not that nobody gets a free ride, that could look after their own requirements, and that is the work that we'll continue to focus on.
I'm Jim Dinnings. My question, you made a comment which I think we're all aware that Bill Shorten in the last election was the second worst result for Labor ever in the history of the party. And yet here we are with the coalition now. We've got a speaker to be appointed and Klingon bites the toenails. Is there any answer to that situation in what happened with Brexit and with the rise of Trump in the States? Is there a disaffection generally in politics and politicians today in the Western world?
It's a fair question. There's no doubt that Labor did get their second worst result in the history, but we didn't get as good a result as we would have liked. We won, and we've got the opportunity to continue to serve in government for another 3 years and to do the best we can. But if you look around the world, there's no doubt that, at a time when, you've got to remember, we're in a circumstance where global economic growth has been slowing for some time. That means that around the world, there are people that are struggling in the face of difficult economic adjustments. And, in those sorts of circumstances, some of the things that we've been able to observe around the world are not necessarily surprising, and Australia is not entirely immune from that. I guess what we can do as people, as political leaders, people with political responsibilities, to just keep reminding people of the upside for a country like Australia to be a genuinely open trading economy in the world. I mean, if we are in our 26, we are entering our 26th year of continuous growth. I mean, I think only the Netherlands has had a longer period of continuous growth than Australia has had. I mean, this is what's been achieved on the back of economic reforms and the Hawke, Keating, Howard, and now Abbott and Turnbull eras has been quite amazing. But when you talk about opening yourself up to global competition, it means that, going all the way back to the Hawke Keating years, it means that, removing tariffs in the context of textile manufacturing was difficult. But I'll never forget Paul Keating in his interview with Kerry O'Brien saying that all of these people who lost jobs in those industries now have, better jobs. We've always got to remind ourselves of the counterfactual. I mean, sometimes people get comfort, being protected in a cocoon, but where you're essentially sort of just stay in some sort of mediocre comfort. Whereas if you expose yourself to global competition, it's hard, but it strives you to be the best you can be, and it forces you to focus on those areas where you can genuinely be the best you can be. And it means that your economy performs to its best potential. And, but in the end, doesn't mean it is easy for everyone, and people who go through periods of personal struggle, might from time to time, express that in, through the political process. But from my point of view, in the end, we've got to make judgments, we've got to try and explain what we're trying to do and why, and hopefully we persuade the majority of people in the majority of seats for as long as possible.
There are a lot of questions here, we're nearly finished, so we'll just take the last two, and then Dimitri.
We had good employment figures last week, and it was shortly followed by an article, I think, in the Australian that explained that those good figures were coming off the back of increased government employment. In other words, increasingly, probably...
Not at the federal level.
Yeah, I was about to say, for the states, where, for example, Queensland has put back as many as the previous government took away. How do we... And all of this, of course, goes on to pensions and, in time, superannuation payouts, more taxpayers' money being spent to employ people. How do we get off that kind of trajectory and get back to putting more people into private business?
Well, private sector growth, private sector employment growth is the game in town, certainly at a federal level. Since we've come into government, we have significantly reduced the number of federal public servants since we came into government. We've reduced the number of government bodies. All of our policies have been focused on incentivizing stronger private sector growth. I mean, export trade deals, it's all about helping Australian exporting businesses get better access to key markets in the world. Reducing the corporate tax rate, it's about incentivizing success. Getting rid of the carbon tax and the mining tax, pursuing investment in infrastructure, which is public sector investment, but which goes into the efficiency of our transport logistics and our capacity to get our products to market in a more efficient, safe and cost-effective way and improve our competitiveness. I mean, all of these things are focused on boosting the success of our private sector so that our private sector can be more successful, can employ more Australians and can pay them better wages over time. I did see that same report, and I did see that some of our state colleagues, I'm sure not here in New South Wales, but in some of the other states, are hiring very aggressively. I mean, in the end, I think it's in our national interest to put the private sector on the strongest possible foundation for the future, and to ensure that the public sector delivers its services effectively, but as efficiently and at the lowest possible cost. As efficient as possible, the lowest possible cost. Sorry,
that was three final questions.
Thanks for your comments, Minister. There's a general doctrine in government financing about beneficiaries paying. And when the Commonwealth intervenes in foreign investment decisions on national security grounds, there's usually an argument that it's an interest of all Australians. Extending that, should the Commonwealth, who currently has a free option to intervene in such asset sales, be required to cut a check to the sellers of assets when they're intervened? For example, should the Commonwealth have to cut a check, a $1 billion check to the New South Wales government for blocking the Osprey sale?
No.
Well, I've always thought that successful politicians are able to say no. Not many do. Look, it's great to have the Finance Minister here again. Talking this time after a budget, but a very significant budget and a very important time coming up. I'll just make a couple of very brief comments. It was great to hear you talk so well of the late Senator Peter Walsh, who was a good friend of ours here at the Sydney Institute and a very powerful figure in the Hawke and Keating government and the economic reforms of that period, so it's nice to remember him. Without question, Matthias Cormann has been one of the star performers of both the Abbott and the Turnbull government. And we're seeing that here tonight as someone who communicates very clearly and directly. And so in your recent position of Deputy Leader of the Government and the Senate, you've got a big job on your hands, and we're very grateful you come here and talk about some of the issues now. No doubt we'll have you back in the future, probably for the fourth budget. But for tonight, thank you and well done.
Thank you. You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.